The information in the Quality of Life radio program is provided for informational purposes only and should not be construed as medical or legal advice on any subject matter. Quality of Life and Ronald Zach Law provides medical and legal advice and other services only to persons or entities with which it has established a formal healthcare provider or attorney-client relationship. The program is paid for by Quality of Life Medical Research Center.
To the Quality of Life radio show. This is your co-host, Ronald Zach. I'm here with Dr. Jack McGettigan, and Veronica Sternitsky is also here. And also we have our guest today is Robert Newton, a former F-16 pilot, test pilot. And we'll get into how all that's related to quality of life, which is anything. And remember, we're talking about quality of life, not just for the living. So we've been experimenting. So this is, of course, live radio. We're coming back to you. Some of you know me from my previous radio show. And one of the things that we try to provide you with is news. And most of the news that I like to provide you with is useless and uninformative. And I'm going to provide some medical and legal news you can't use. Medical and legal news you can't use. So I dig up a few stories here. And these stories you can follow also on my Facebook page, Ronald Zach Law. And the first story, it deals with the one chip challenge. If you're a big TikTok fan, as I am, you're probably familiar with the one chip challenge. This is a chip. I think it's called a Pocky. Now, don't confuse that with Taki, because a lot of people eat Takis. Pocky, P like Paul, A-Q-U-I. And it's a very spicy chip. You buy this at like a convenience store, gas station, where I often dine. And these are extremely spicy chips. You got one chip in a little box that's shaped like a coffin. And you're supposed to eat this chip and try not to drink anything. And then you can post this on TikTok and see how long you can last without drinking or throwing up or something. Well, this is kind of the sad part of it. So unfortunately, there was a death, a teenager. Now, this is not for kids. This is supposed to be an adult game. I don't know what adults play this game, but it is an adult game. And this young 14-year-old participated in the challenge. It's a big social media thing, and he died. Now, they don't know that that's related to the chip challenge or the chip, but they are very concerned about it. Pocky has asked retailers to stop selling this. And Pocky, by the way, is a subsidiary of Hershey. So there's a sweet side to this, too. So he was playing with three other students at a California high school and got sick and went to the hospital. There's a lot of capsaicin in there. And capsaicin also has medical uses, right, Dr. McGettigan?
It does indeed.
And we use that. So we'll maybe talk more about that later. Another news story. Scientists have discovered a link between internet use and dementia. What? So, and my first thought was, oh, crap, you know, because I'm on the internet a lot, especially TikTok. But this link is that it's cognitively helpful to be on the internet. And this is a study that was published in the Journal of the American Geriatric Society, where people who were active users of the internet had a 1.54% risk of developing dementia. If you didn't use the internet, you had a 10.45% risk. Now, again, is that cause and effect? I don't know. Maybe it's just healthier people are on the internet more. But it's very interesting to consider that the internet may have something to do with preventing dementia. That would be one of the only positive effects, maybe. There's, and I'm not seeing our clock here. Somewhere the time left, but so if I run out of time, or I may talk on for an hour.
No, you won't.
Thank you. There's a guy in Las Vegas. This is kind of a sad story, but it's interesting. It's interesting to see when efforts to do good do bad. And this is a story about a man named Clifford Allen in Las Vegas. He was missing. I think in his 70s. I don't see his exact age. He's only 60. He had passed out from extreme heat in Las Vegas, passed out on the street. And of course, the first thing people do when that happens is someone came along, took his wallet. And then left with that. So when he was taken to the hospital, nobody knew who he was. He had no identification. And he was in the hospital for a couple weeks, and he died. And his sister, that entire time, that's a 75-year-old sister, was looking for him. They lived together. He was listed as a Nolan Doe. Now, she was asking if there was any John Doe, and the hospital said no. But hospitals are very reluctant to give any information out about any patient because of HIPAA, the Privacy Act from the federal government, and so it's a shame that nobody said anything about him. He died alone in the hospital, and it wasn't until after he left the hospital that authorities were permitted, under some guidelines from some authority in Las Vegas, they were permitted to fingerprint him and find out who he was through his fingerprints. So the hospital had tried to get him fingerprinted, but we often, I've had other cases too, where people just simply could not get any information about a relative who was in the hospital, and it's, as part of your estate planning documents, you should have a HIPAA authorization, something that would give certain people the authority that they could show to the hospital that would allow them to get that information. Mohammed El Fayed, is that how you say it? Fayed?
That sounds right.
Is that right? He was, as you recall, he owned Harrods. He owned lots of stuff, billions of dollars. He's best known, what's he best known for? He's best known for being the father of Dodi, who was Princess Diana's friend, who was killed with Princess Diana. About 26 years, almost to the date, Mohammed El Fayed died. He died on August 30th of this year. Princess Diana and Dodi were killed on August 31st, 1997. Now, there's four other kids, Jasmine, Kareem, Camilla, and Omar, who have been involved in their business, and they have been fighting for quite some time. They didn't wait for their dad to die to start fighting, and this is a trust and estates litigator's dream, that these kids are not going to get along. They're not going to agree on anything. And there's millions and millions of dollars, billions, actually, to be fighting over. And it's they call it, one of the siblings calls it a sibling power struggle, which is a good name for it. We see that a lot in our practice. If you remember, Mohammed El Fayed was he always believed that the monarchy was behind the death of his son and of Princess Diana, and he believes that the truth will eventually come out. I don't believe it will. We still don't know about John F. Kennedy, so we won't know about that. But we do have an F-16 pilot here we're going to talk to today. We are going to ask him about UFOs. because we know that he's got some information. here's a story. You know, it's very important to keep exercising, and Peloton bikes. Remember, they became so popular during the pandemic because people could get these bikes. I don't really know what they do. I don't exercise. In my role as a primary care nurse practitioner, I tell people to exercise, but I myself don't often exercise. Maybe I should get a Peloton bike. But this woman is suing Peloton because her son died when his bike toppled on him. The Peloton program, because you listen to this program and it tells you to get off the bike, do these certain things. And one, he got off to do some of the things he was being told on the floor. He grabbed the bike for leverage to stand up, and the bike fell over on him and severed an artery, and he died. There was, if you recall, a previous death of a 3-year-old who had a brain injury in 2021 from a similar incident. Peloton stock is probably not stock you want to buy anymore. The company's not doing well. That concludes our first segment. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back and we're going to be talking with Jack McGettigan, Robert Newton, Veronica Sternitsky, Charles Heller, me, anyone who wants to call.
By the way, Peloton did have a statement about it.
What did they say? It wasn't our fault.
We'll be back after this.
Thank you.
Those are some interesting nuggets you dug up there.
Over the years, you've brought them into your home. You were prescribed opioids after the C-section, when Dad injured his back, when your basketball star tore his ACL. Opioids helped with the pain, and you held on to them, just in case. But did you know holding on to unused opioids puts your family at risk? Opioids are powerful, pain-reducing prescription medicines, but most people who are prescribed opioids don't finish their prescriptions. So millions of unused opioids are sitting in homes across the country. And tragically, more than 100 Americans die every day from overdoses involving opioids. What can you do to protect your family? Remove the risk of unused opioids from your home. Pills, patches, or syrups in drawers, purses, and cabinets. Anywhere they might be hiding. To find out how to dispose of them properly, visit www.fda.gov/drug disposal.
United States Deputy Sheriff's Association is a national nonprofit and America's largest non-governmental provider of services to law enforcement. USDSA assists city, county, state, and federal law enforcement agencies through our many varied programs, including free safety equipment donations, free officer survival training, cash donations, and condolence letters to the family of law enforcement officers who perished in the line of duty. USDSA also provides a citizen awareness program and thank you cards to law enforcement. These are just some of the ways United States Deputy Sheriff's Association assists America's law enforcement and the citizens they serve. For more information about United States Deputy Sheriff's Association or to see how you can help, please visit usdeputy.org. United States Deputy Sheriff's Association, taking training to the next level, because lives are on the line.
Have you been told that you need a trust to avoid probate? Not true. Have you been told that a trust will always avoid probate? That's not true either. If avoiding probate is your goal, I can help you with an estate plan that avoids probate after your death without the extra work and expense of a trust. If you need a trust for other reasons, I can help with that too. Learn the truth about trusts.
You can reach Ronald Zach Law at 520-999-3738. That's 999-3738. Or RonaldZachLaw.com.
Welcome back to Quality of Life Radio with your hosts, Dr. Jack Begedigan, Ronald Zach, and Veronica Sternitsky. Jack Begedigan is the founder of Quality of Life Medical and Research Center and has been a practicing physician for many, many years in Tucson area and has done a great deal of important, significant research. And we will be promoting some of those things here on the show. And as some of you know, I'm a certified trust and estate attorney and have been practicing in that area for many years. I'm also a certified nurse practitioner, family nurse practitioner, and I work part of my time at the Quality of Life Medical and Research Center. We're going to be talking in a moment with Robert Newton, a former F-16 pilot and test pilot, and you're welcome to join the conversation. We'd love it if you do by calling 520-790-2040, 520-790-2040. And with that, we do welcome your calls. And Dr. McGettigan, would you like to tell us anything about Mr. Newton?
Well, yes, I would. I twisted his arm recently to ask him to join us. Thought he could add a little color and flavor to our show as we're figuring out exactly what we would like to do. Bob and I go back not that long ago, but I'm going to let him explain a little bit how he knows me. But first, I'd like to introduce him as a friend. It's an honor to have him here, but he's a great friend. He's also a ski buddy of mine. And I'd like to say we're fellow pilots, but I think that that might be stretching the truth a little bit about me compared to him. But I'd like to welcome retired Colonel Robert Newton, also known as Juice by his Air Force colleagues and other flying buddies. Bob, do you recall when we first met?
It was early on as you were looking at flying in the Columbia, and we went out and did basically what we call a qualival of the aircraft. And so Jack had a chance to jump in the airplane with me, and off we went. And I think it's the shared joy of flying that kind of pulled us together. We enjoyed that. In fact, we've got one of the finest places to fly anywhere in the world, and I've been around most of it. And so off we went.
And you've been in Tucson how long?
We moved here in, I guess it was 04.
And what brought you here?
The flying weather. No kidding. I looked at a lot of different places. I did have an Air Force job here, but this was the kind of environment I was really looking forward to, kind of retiring and going to that next chapter of life. And a big part of that was to have a good flying environment, and this is it. I don't think you can find any place any better than this. A lot of times we talk about flying during the day, but the night flying here, again, is just glorious.
The thing that intrigues me about you, and I'd love for you just to spend a few minutes telling us what flying an F-16 is like, because I've just been in these kind of slow planes, and I love flying level, and I have a sense that maybe that's not what you guys learned to do.
You know, it's that's an interesting question, especially for an older guy. When I started out, the F-16 was new, and so while I wasn't the initial cadre in the F-16, I was very early on, and so they call me a Viper baby, you know, one of the groups that out of flight school goes right to the F-16. And obviously, it was a sharp and neat airplane. Had a lot of those features that people would kind of yearn for. But there's a naivete, I think, as a young pilot going into the airplane that just, okay, great, got it. And so we almost take it for granted. And reflecting back on it, I think we did. And it had plenty of challenges associated with it. And so off you go. You got to learn how to fly it. In fact, we were kind of developing all the missions and activities that you could do. And it definitely the tactics were immature because they were kind of based a lot on the F-4 and the previous generation of fighters. And that's not what we had in the airplane. The performance we had was radically better than what they had been dealing with. Thank you very much to the Vietnam vets that kind of drove it that way. And it was certainly exciting. You see some of the videos that are out there today where you can set it on the tail and kind of accelerate going up. And yeah, we'd go out and do that stuff. And at the time, we knew that was really a toot. It was a great thing to, and a lot of fun to do. But at the same time, it was very serious and a professional business. And we kind of all approached it that way. There were hazards associated with it. In fact, as we talk about quality of life, we were living right on the edge. And we ended up losing some guys. And that's one of those wake-up calls that this isn't just a game. And that was before any of the combat operations were going.
And you have a family?
Yes.
Any pilots in the family?
Pretty much all of them.
How about your wife? Have you convinced her yet?
Well, you know, it's funny. I've talked to her about that, and I just haven't been able to get her on board. But all the boys are in there. My brothers are mostly up on that. In fact, that's kind of where we got it. My father was a pilot, so even as little kids, we'd go out with him. And that gave us the exposure. And we kind of just build it up from there.
Did you have a leg up at all being a pilot already when it went to learning how to fly the F-16? Or was that maybe a detriment that you knew how to do it a different way?
Actually, back in the day, the flight school wanted you to be a fairly low-time pilot so they could teach you the Air Force and the military way of flying. And so they kind of shaded away from a whole lot of experience. That's changed. Today, they want people that have more experience. And, you know, we could probably sit and debate the rationale for things like that. But I do know the Air Force approach to flight training back then was well proven.
Any idea why it changed?
I think it may have been driven by cost. I think another factor is that, and this came in later as I was working in the flight test world, we really got to where we could dial in how the airplanes flew. Okay, very consistent. In fact, you look at the modern aircraft with the fly-by-wire and augmented flight control systems, we can tune the airplane to be very good to fly. Turn back the clock back in the day. It was a seat of the pants. How does this plane fly compared to other planes? Much more difficult. And so now we've got it to where it's a lot easier to fly.
So the F-16 has a SPAD mode?
A SPAD mode.
SPAD.
Yeah.
The World War One fighter.
Right. You know, I was very involved with flight control law development, both on the F-16 as well as F-22 and the later aircraft. And we tune them. And guess how you design the airplane? You want it to respond to the pilot as the pilot desires. And we can do some rather miraculous things along those lines, especially when you look at some degraded flight control modes and such. And that's all good. And in the end, we're developing these aircraft to do a mission. And so everything comes back to the mission. And so that mission perspective is kind of the key, and I think that's one of the passion things that some of us get is, why do we do it? Well, okay, it's neat to do, but why do you fly the F-16, or why are you doing this? It's for the mission, and so it always comes back to the mission.
So did your training take place here in Tucson?
No. In fact, I started off, flight school was at Reese Air Force Base, now closed down in Lubbock, Texas. And then went to fighter lead-in at Holloman in New Mexico, still around, and then up to Hill Air Force Base. And Hill is where I started in the F-16.
And do they do training here in Tucson?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yes. In fact, they do F-16 training.
That's
here
at
the Tucson International Airport, the 162nd wing. And then, of course, they do the A-10 home is right here at DM, Davis-Monthan.
And those guys are constantly in my way when I'm trying to fly at Tucson. They think they've got the right of way for some reason.
Better watch out.
You said earlier that you were a relatively low-hour pilot going into flight training, into training for the aircraft you were working with. Did you find it difficult to transition to other aircraft later?
No, actually, it's something we've actually studied. We look to see what are the qualities that make a pilot a fighter pilot or a good pilot. And it's one of those things you can't quite tell just looking at people or even interviewing them. You have to find the qualities, especially on the very challenging tasks. And I think that formation flying is one of those type of tasks where you're flying fast in a very dynamic environment with someone else. And how do you respond to it? You don't have the skills to fly it well because you haven't done it, right? So how do you respond to it? Well, you're going to get scared and shy away from it and pull back. And is your attitude to sit there and say, well, okay, I know I can do that. Why? Because I've seen these other guys do it. And then you get back in there. So you overcome your fear with almost a blind confidence that you're going to go make it happen. And not everyone does that. Other people come out there and go, okay, that is stupid to do. I'm going to get away from this. No, I'm not going back in close against that other airplane. So that's one of those traits that is very difficult to predict. But they've come a long way in really diving down and understanding what the skills are. And I would say now there's a lot more three-dimensional envisioning of the dynamics of the fight in the mission that you're out flying. So it's changed quite a bit. It's in a lot of good ways, especially when you think about gamers and in the various tools that are out there to learn.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll come back with Robert Newton and find out why he's called Juice. Welcome back. You're listening to Quality of Life Radio and hosted by Jack McGettigan, medical doctor, and Ronald Zach, attorney. And we're here with Veronica Sternitsky, another attorney, and our guest, Robert Newton, F-16, former F-16 pilot, and many, many other things as well. And of course, I don't know if I mentioned it, but you may hear Charles Heller's voice if you're familiar with that.
It's all right.
And he's running our board. And you can call us and join the conversation if you have a question. 520-790-2040. I'm sure with as many hours flying as Robert Newton has had, and also we have two other pilots in the room here. Veronica and Jack are also pilots, and you may want to ask about UFOs. They've all certainly had experiences. So I wanted just to ask why your nickname is Juice.
The tradition of coming up with call signs for fighter pilots is gone back a long way. And at the time, usually it's something infamous you do. It may be good, maybe not so good. It could be a ring on your last name, like in my case. At the time, we used to go out after hours and maybe sing a little bit. Not that I was the greatest singer by any means, but Juice Newton at the time was out and about. Fig was a pretty common one for anyone with a last name of Newton, and there were a couple of them around, including my oldest brother. And so Juice is what was bestowed upon me by some of my friends, and I guess it rang and it worked. So here it is, decades later.
Very good.
Oh, UFOs. You know, there's certainly been unidentified objects or phenomena, which is the latest thing for forever. And yes, I've gone out and I've seen things I didn't know what it was. It was unidentified. I'm not sure it's not just a diversion. You know, do aliens exist or other unknown things? Certainly, there's a possibility. I'm not sure that it's anything of great significance in this day and age.
It very often I hear it's either swamp gas or a weather balloon.
Well, I mean, we had a balloon not long ago floating up over Montana and then across the nation.
That's true.
And yeah, I mean, there's strange things that go on out there that we don't quite understand. And you're not typically out there looking for balloons up high, but you know, right here in our backyard, Worldview launches balloons out of Tucson, and you know, these envelopes, you know, rise up and all of a sudden they become big balls flying at 100,000 feet and above. And so, yeah, that's a little bit unique. And so what does it look like? Well, it depends. It could be a reflection if it's late in the day or whatever.
We were talking earlier, before we actually went on the air, about passion, your passion, current passion for other people.
Okay. And... we have a caller, if you'd like.
Yeah, I didn't hear
I can't
you,
hear. Oh. Hang on 1 second. And we have a caller, you were saying?
Can you? Yo, you okay?
Yeah.
Okay, right. There, we do have a caller on the line.
Stand by for just one moment, and we're going to go. Yeah, tell caller to call back. That's fine. They tell them to screw their courage to the sticking place and let it ring a while, and that's okay. Are we up for a break, or were you stopping for a moment?
No, I wasn't hearing through my
well, that's headphones. An interesting question. I'll find out why. But please continue on. I can hear you. And the audience can hear you.
Go ahead, Jack.
You didn't hear the last question? Or?
I was asking you about your passion.
Oh.
At this point in time. And I got a curious question for you. Your favorite flying device right now is a power parachute?
That's right. Well, so... you know, we go out there and we fly Mach 2 or 1,000 miles an hour with the F-16. And after I retired, we were looking at helping out the special ops community. And we started flying powered parachutes, which is about the slowest airplane that you can go out and fly. And it's kind of interesting because it's like sitting in a lawn chair while you're flying. So you are out in the elements. It's about as pure as it can get with no visible means of support. And so, yeah, we do that. And again, out here in Arizona, it's just a wonderful place to go out and fly fast or slow.
We do have a caller on the line, and it's Rick. Hey, Rick, thank you for calling.
Hi. I only waited, it's not that long, I think 7 years for the Law and Order show to come back, but glad to have you back.
Thank you so much.
Question. Thank you for your service for the guest. And, sir, did you deploy? I didn't catch the very beginning of the show. Did you deploy to Afghanistan or Iraq? I was there as an advisor for the DOD, and I had the opportunity to witness, I was there, a gun run from an A-10 and an ordnance deployment from a fast mover. And can you give, in your opinion there, the difference in those theaters, if you were there, between the A-10 and the F-16 and the foreseeable future without the A-10? I hope that's not too convoluted of a question.
No, it's a very good question. And I was both in Afghanistan and Iraq, not during the Desert Storm era. I was in a different desert, Edwards, at that time. But the later period, we went out and we were looking to do the mission better in Afghanistan and Iraq. To your point with regard to the A-10, there's an interesting dilemma from my perspective with regard to the Air Force and how they view conflict. And so if you kind of envision a near-peer fight, i.e. World War III, with a very tough integrated air defense system, and the case where you're out, what I used to joke is that we're out fighting the Flintstones in Afghanistan. And so do I need... you know, this very high-end fast fighter that's survivable against a near-peer threat there? Well, not really. But what do I develop? How do I train if I'm going to be out there with the potential to go to war with a near-peer threat? And so there's a dilemma there. The general thought is, if I have a high-end fighter and I have a high-end readiness on my force, I can always roll back to a lower threat. I just can't do it efficiently. So how do you balance efficiency in terms of operation? Well, guess what? A-10, very efficient. It's the lowest cost fighter that we have in the Air Force. the gun is a very effective weapon, very precise. And so that's the struggle. I spent time in the Pentagon. That's probably why I have this distorted perspective on things. But, you know, that's the kind of dilemma that's going on. And I would argue that you need a balanced force. You don't need just the high-end, high-cost force. You need a balanced force. But the A-10 is quite old. I mean, it's been around a while, and it still does the mission exceedingly well. Everyone in this neighborhood of DM knows and values the A-10. I'll tell you what, it put the fear of God in the adversaries that we had in those theaters. And so, go ahead.
Oh, sorry, I thought you were finished. I didn't mean to interrupt you. The Afghans called it where I was at. I was in Paktika and coast, and the Afghans called it the Dragon, or the Taliban, because of the sound of the gun, and they didn't like it. They didn't like it one bit.
There you go.
What do you make of that ground support crop duster that they're going to be using to try and replace the A-10 in uncontested areas?
Yeah, SOCOM's the one that has been pushing this, and again, they wanted to get what we call this lower light attack sort of capability. In fact, we supported a study with SOCOM on doing that, and I think it's a good thing. Again, this is balanced force. You don't have to take an F-35 out into some of these third world places to fight the Flintstones. You just don't need it. You need something that's going to be very good to support the troops that are in close, and there are many cases where we're not fighting from a distance. We've got troops on the ground, they're in contact, and you need to have this type of asset available. So I think it's a great thing.
Would you mind expanding what you mean by balanced force?
Balanced force means I just don't have high-end, high-performance, near-peer sort of weaponry. I have things that are tailored for the low-end as well. And that's very tough to do because you're sitting there. Can you ever get too good for the near-peer fight? Well, no. So how do I take some portion of my investments and bring it down to this low-end need? It's really a tough challenge for an institution like the Air Force or the DOD in general to balance that out. So it comes back to what we were talking about a little bit earlier about leadership. And it's judgment. It's a judgment call that's the right thing to do, and they can obviously make the case, and they get the support to go out and do something like the armed capabilities that they're doing now.
And thanks so much to Rick for calling. We appreciate that. And just before we take the break, in view of some of your comments, I wanted to mention that when the military was studying some of the culture of the Middle East, they had discovered that most of the people in the United Arab Emirates did not understand Flintstone humor, but the people in Abu Dhabi do. We're going to take a break, and we'll be right back with, we're going to have a little more of Robert Newton.
Hey, I'm not sure the kids know that either.
Welcome back. You're listening to Quality of Life Radio on KVOI 1030 The Voice, and you can call us at 520-790-2040. We're going to get to a caller in just a minute, but before we do, we have Robert Newton here, our guest, and I wanted to mention next week's show. So next week, Dr. McGettigan and Robert are going to be at the Reno Air Show, and I think it's the last Reno Air Show. That's what I've heard.
Well, it's the air races. So it's kind of a combination of show, but the race is really why we're there.
Ah, okay. And so we're gonna try to do some remote interviews next week from Reno. I don't get to go. I don't think Veronica gets to go. We're gonna be sitting in here. But Dr. McGettigan and Corporal. Colonel, I don't know my military. Colonel Newton are going to be there. So we have a couple of callers to get to. Michelle, thank you for calling.
Thank you.
What's your question?
Okay, I have a question for Robert Newton. I was wondering if he has any good stories to share in his deployments.
Wow. Yeah, for sure. I'll tell you one quick one. In fact, this hit me much later. But I was stationed in Korea in 85, pretty much the whole year. And we went over there, and basically it's a one-year remote assignment. And so you can imagine training was a big thing. So we would have exercises every month. And we were assigned in the squadron 24 aircraft. We had a couple extras for what they call battlefield attrition and other reserve aircraft. But we were able to fly a lot. In fact, each exercise we would generate all of the airplanes we were assigned, 100%. Which is like impressive. It's a different class from what we're doing today. And I'm thinking, well, pilots, we love that because now we can go fly. In reality, the work that the maintainers and the weapons and the logisticians did was why we were able to fly. They were able to, we broke the airplanes, they could fix them and turn them and generate them. And so that story, when you think about the teamwork and the skill and the hard work that all of these maintainers and logisticians and weapons loaders and stuff did was just incredible. I'm just awed to this day as to how well that works. So there's a war story for you.
I bet there's a lot of stories. Michelle, thanks so much for calling. And we have another caller, Mark.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. And sorry my voice is not functioning properly here today, but I'm very interested in your powered paraglider things. I'm guessing that's what you do. I always wanted to be a fighter pilot, but it became obvious when I was in high school that there was something that was going to not allow me to do that called vision. And anyway, so I became a hang glider pilot and paraglider pilot and sailplane pilot, skydiver and bungee jumper from hot air balloons and whatever I could do with altitude. So I guess my next thing is the wingsuit jumping, but maybe I'll wait till they perfect that when I'm in my 90s or something like that. So,
well, that would be the
I'd
riskiest.
Like to hear more about your, yeah, they do smear themselves across the landscape quite frequently. But anyway, I'd like to hear more about your low and slow flying.
You know, the thing that really drove me to even get involved with that was the mission that the special operators have. And as it stands today, parachuting into hotspots is one of the methods that they have. They train very hard for it. We've got everything from the Army airborne units to the special ops community that goes in there, and it's kind of a one-way thing. Shortly after I was in Afghanistan, the Navy SEALs had the problem with the lone survivor, if you remember that. And so the guys are stuck with their transportation, which is the Mark I legs. That's what they have. And they don't have a vehicle or any way to get around. And so we said, well, we should be able to do better than that. And that's why we kind of got into this parafoil thing. It's a skill set that the special ops community has. And so if you had a motor and wheels that allow them to drive around, it's the potential was that they could have greater mobility in the enemy's backyard than the enemy. Why? Because you could fly. You get that third dimension, yeah. You take off and you go fly, pack it up. You know, your wing stuffs into a bag very nicely. And so that's why we ended up getting into that. And then, you know, back to our comment earlier about passion. If you like aviating, which clearly you do, and yes, your eyesight was maybe insufficient to allow you to go down the fighter path, but if you like to fly, guess what? You can get out there and you can do it. And these type of systems are out there today. I would say that economically it's a little more difficult than it used to be, but boy, don't let it stop, because it's a very freeing sort of experience. And when you're a little slower like that, you can get very low and you can go see the wildlife and do everything else. So it's a lot of fun. No doubt you've seen some of that with the parachuting you've done.
Yeah. And, well, so far of all the things I've done with altitude, hang gliding is the absolute most realistic thing to really flying. And, you know,
have you considered, Mark, have you considered the circus? I understand they're looking for people to be shot out of the cannon.
Well, I guess maybe I could wear a wingsuit with that. It might work.
Well, there happens to be the Arizona Flying Circus that goes each year, and it's done up to the west of Casa Grande. So, yes, you can actually fly into the circus, the Arizona Flying Circus.
And so anyway, yeah, so hang gliding was the best thing I've ever really done. I always thought, well, sailplane flying, that I could do that when I'm too old to, you know, drag my gliders up to launches and whatever.
Have you tried the weight shift? Because that's basically the same thing with an engine.
I don't know what that is. The weight shift? Is that a name?
It's a light sport category called weight shift. And you could just Google that, and you'll see that's something that you'd feel right at home. It's the exact same control inputs, but you have an engine to keep you going.
Okay. So that's not like the powered rocket suit kind of a thing?
No.
Rocket wing? Okay.
Well, Mark, thank you very much for calling. So I'm sitting here with all these pilots and callers like Mark who are doing all these daring things, and my aspiration is to fly business class. I'm looking forward to doing that sometime. But it's mm-hmm. it's all exciting.
Well, maybe the next thing would be a personalized multi-copter.
Maybe.
You know, like
they're working hard on that. They want this this air taxi to be able to go like the Jetsons and get you around from point to point very effectively. We've come a long way. I mean, there's some neat flying vehicles out there for sure.
Yeah. Well, thanks for your show today.
Thank you, Mark. Thanks for listening and for calling. We're getting close to the end of the show. I wanted to ask though, so this power parachute, it's you do you need a sport pilot license for it? Is that
correct?
What it is? Okay, and that's a little easier to get.
Yes. It does have some restrictions, but it's not particularly difficult to do.
Well, very, very interesting. We thank you so much for being here, Robert Newton, and thanks my co-host Jack McGettigan for setting that up.
You still have a minute.
And our music started. This is live radio, by the way. We're always going to try to be live and imperfect. We we're going to be back next week from the Reno air race, not air show. Is that?
I think it's a little bit of both. But
both.
Robert would probably, he's been going for years. This will be my first adventure.
Well, the Reno Air Spectacle.
You'll hear some music of these racers coming around that will just be extra special. You'll really like it. And I appreciate the time and opportunity to meet you and spend time here.
Oh, thank you so much. We're looking forward to hearing more from you next week. We're looking forward to having all of our listeners back next week and callers. Thank you so much. And thank you, Charles. Thank you, Veronica. Jack McGettigan. Quality of Life Radio, not just for the living.